Hey, welcome back to another episode of This Is Hot Boga. If you haven't had a chance to go over to iTunes or Podbean, go ahead and give us a smash on that subscribe button and a friendly five-star review.
Go on Instagram and rub on that follow button if you want as well, because we'd appreciate that too. Before we get into our exciting guest today, we got to thank a few sponsors first up. Jared, what colors are rabbit, deer, elk, and moose?
Probably shades of brown.
They're shades of brown. Exactly. If green were such a good camo color, then these animals would have been green coming out.
Very well said.
And that's why ASAD, it's not really why, ASAD has a fantastic design. It breaks up your silhouette really well. Learn more at asadcamo.com. Go ahead.
The next sponsor we would like to thank is Fish Hunt Fight Gear.
FHF.
They hooked us up with some sweet bino harnesses that are comfortable and really holds our S7 binoculars really great. Go over on their Facebook page and Instagram page and also their website. They have one of those, fhfgear.com.
Hey, Jared.
Hey, Jim.
Did you know that Northern Broadheads offers a single and a double bevel broadhead for both compound and traditional hunters? So if you ever decide to go back to the wheelie bows, as Adam would call them, you are going to be set. Did you know any of this?
Of course.
Well, excellent. I don't have anything else to tell you. Go check them out. Northern Broadheads. We love them.
Our RK1s from Newbury Archery really made it easier for me and James to be adaptable to the traditional world. These custom bolts were made exactly for us and how we wanted them. I got mine dipped in ASAT, and it's absolutely beautiful. Check it out.
Because they do custom dipping and stuff too. Bowworks and Kyle and all those guys do a great job with that.
Newbreedarchery.com.
All right, Hex is a revolutionary company that blocks your natural electrical energy fields. Yes, that's right. So you get a better hunting experience. All living creatures emit this electrical signal. If your heart is beating or your muscles are moving, then you are producing these fields. The thing is, Hex will block these so animals can't sense you and you can get real close, which we need because we're not great shots. This is real. Mike was a guest and they even were featured on Shark Week. So if you're into that kind of thing, check them out, hexhunting.com. War-Torn Archery makes some awesome stabilizers. They're very customizable. They have different lengths. You can get a back bar extension if you're a compound guy. We even run them on our traditional archery equipment. Check them out, wartornarchery.com. Jared, do you use a rangefinder when you're out hunting?
I do, yeah.
What if I told you that you could get a bow sight with the rangefinder built in? So you look at it, something far away, you push the button, it'll tell you the range and it'll adjust your sight for you. Would you be interested in that?
I'd tell you you're crazy.
Well, I'm not. Burris makes such a bow sight. So go to burrisoptics.com to learn more.
Hey, this is Kevin.
Hey, Kevin, how are you?
Not bad. I'm glad I was able to get all the technological stuff working out on this end.
Yeah, it sounds like you were. Are you on the landline?
Yes, I am. It's so much better. Cell phone service is horrible where I am.
Where are you located?
I'm in Connecticut. I'm in Farmington.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So yeah, it's not the best service. I'm in a dead zone, and even my friends that are on the local police department over here, they say, yeah, you know, you really need to check your cell phone service and keep a landline charged up at all times, because if I tried calling in an emergency, it's not getting through.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's that bad.
Are you back in the woods a bit then?
You know, Connecticut isn't all woods. I'm more in like a suburb, but you know, there's a stretch where it's just, there's no real good view of a cell phone tower. So yeah, it's hit or miss sometimes.
Yeah, crazy. Well, I'm glad I can hear you fine. I'm glad you're here. Thanks for taking the time
to talk. Yeah, perfect.
Today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Cool. Well, let's get started. I always tell people I have to double check that I hit record.
You use that story way too much now.
But dude, because we have recorded in the past and not really actually recorded. We just talked for an hour and a half over the airwaves. So yeah, we're all good. Well, thanks for joining us today, Kevin.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about what you do. And I know you do a couple things. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So I wear a few different hats. I mean, first and foremost, what most people know me as is a high school history teacher. I've been teaching high school history for the past 13 years in a urban public school. But you know, what a lot of people know me for, aside from that, is outdoor survival. And I've been a survival instructor first with the Wilderness Learning Center as their lead survival instructor from 2007 to 2012, and then my own company from 2011 to the present. You know, I've been teaching classes and training people all around the country and writing for a number of different magazines, probably close to 20 at this point, with well over 130 published magazine articles and countless more online. And now I have a new book coming out on April 16th.
Yeah, we're getting really close to that.
I've pre-ordered it.
Have
just
you?
To let you know, I'm a paying customer.
Hell yeah. Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah.
Did you write in there that you want a signed copy from your friend, Kevin?
I would love that. I mean, is it an upcharge? I'll upcharge it.
Well, the funny thing is that I've had so many people ask me, yeah, you know, are you able to accept copies and could you send me a signed copy? And the thing is that, you know, there's only a couple places that will have signed copies already and they'll go out. But if anyone just grabs me and says, hey, you know, you have a pen, I'm always going to have a pen on me. I'll sign a copy anywhere I am. It just gets tricky when, you know, I don't want to have a 100 copies of books sitting on my
right.
porch and, you know what I mean? Like, I don't. Yeah. I just don't. I also don't want to have the books get damaged and shipping. It just becomes a nightmare. So I just told people, if you see me around the campfire or if you see me at a trade show, just pull me aside and I will have no problem signing then and there. But it just gets tricky going through the mail.
So if someone were to say, hey, would you sign my copy? Would you write like a special note? Mm. Would you say something like, "Go,
don't die"?
Yeah, you know, would you give them a tip or would you just write your name in there?
I'd probably write, you know, I've been thinking about that quite honestly.
Yeah.
You know, it depends on the person. If it's some total stranger, I'm sure I'll have some catchphrase that I'll think of. Whether it's like, you know, what I always say with my friends, like, you know, proven in the field or, you know, prove these in the field, you know, to or own these skills. That's another thing I'm always
like taught,
you know, saying like own them. But if it's a good friend or if it's someone that I've known for a long time, that just seems kind of cheap. Just to be like, oh, you know, stay alive.
Yeah.
Stay alive.
Yeah, stay alive, brother. Dude, you said that in mine too.
Yeah. So I guess depending on how well I know the person, I'll, you know, make it either really short or actually make it heartfelt.
So history teacher.
Yes, sir.
What era, or is it, you know, is it kind of a multiple different eras? Is this like American history? Are we looking at ancient history? What are we talking?
Well, right now, my course load is I'm teaching modern American history. So that's from like Reconstruction forward. I'm also a human geography teacher for College Board. So I do a college level class that's open to all levels.
Okay.
But it's, you know, kids that are, you know, trying to get college credit in high school. So we do AP human geography, studying all different parts of the world. Kids get a chance to understand why, you know, people live where they live, why the market works the way that the market works, how products move from one country to another. So
nice.
I get a chance every once in a while to incorporate some really high interest stuff. And we always look at current events. You know, if I want to be an exciting and interesting history teacher as opposed to that dry, boring guy that we all probably imagine.
I've had one of those.
Yeah, I think we all had at some point. So I think I owe it to the kids to bring a little excitement to the classroom.
What's your favorite time period to teach?
Oh, Mongols. Absolutely.
Really? Why?
You know, well, I mean, you guys will appreciate it being, you know, archers. These guys are just total badasses.
Yeah.
I mean, they had the largest empire in the history of the world. They drank fermented mare's milk, which I've never partied that way, but I'm totally cool
with
that.
Hey, man, whatever gets, you know, whatever scratches that itch.
Yeah, you know, and then, I mean, let's just face it. They were fierce guys. They didn't know how to expand, though, and that's what ultimately was their demise. They just got too big. And, you know, I always tell the kids, like, no great civilization has lasted forever. You know,
right.
Even though these Mongols were so awesome, they're nowhere to be seen anymore. You can't find Genghis Khan's grave and the Mongols. You can still see some remnants of their civilization, but, you know, it's long gone. So, yeah, those are my favorite to teach.
Well, and they tried to fight a land war in Asia. And if as anyone can tell you, you can't fight a land war
in
Asia.
I've played Risk many times.
And the Princess Bride, you know, would go and say, you can't do that. Yeah, it's funny.
Yeah, inconceivable.
Inconceivable. Oh, classic.
Point, Kevin.
That's right. So you not only are a teacher, but you work and teach people bushcraft, which is
correct.
Define bushcraft for us.
So bushcraft has had a lot of definitions over the years. I mean, the one that it's really become popularized in the past, say, 15, 20 years with Ray Mears, who's really like the godfather of bushcraft, along with Morris Kachansky, you know, from Alberta, Canada. Then there is Richard Graves from Australia. And bushcraft is really just using your natural resources instead of relying on gear, doing more with less, being able to convert your resources into what you need. So there's a lot of woodcraft and carving. I mean, bushcraft is one of those political terms, too, that depending on who you talk to, they may like the fact that you're calling it bushcraft versus woodcraft or woodsman skills. But I basically tell people it's the way of doing more with less and utilizing natural resources whenever possible in a sustainable way. Instead of bringing along all the cordage that you need, you know, you'd utilize the natural cordage, whether it's roots or tulip poplar or whatever you can process in the field. You know, it's doing more with less and using the resources to your advantage.
So it's very similar to only having one map app on your phone, doing more with less.
Right. You know, being really limited. only 3G, not 4G.
That's right. Yeah. MapQuest printed off. You got into backcountry bushcraft at a young age, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, so I always tell people my story is, you know, it's not like a lot of, you know, American kids. I grew up here. I was born in New Britain, Connecticut, and I grew up in Bristol, Connecticut. But my dad is Filipino. My dad came over in 1965, and you know, he recently turned 80. So love you, Dad, if you're listening to this one.
He's a hot bogus subscriber.
Yeah, you never know. All those Filipinos. But he came over in 65. But the real interesting thing with my dad is that during World War II, my grandfather had moved the entire town into the jungle when the Japanese Imperial Army had invaded. Wow. So as a little kid, my dad grew up in the jungle from 1941 until 1945. They lived there while Japan had occupied all of the Philippines.
Wow. And
they lived in a cave system along with a bunch of townspeople. They only came out at night. They had a fake jungle wall that they put up on the outside of the cave entrance. And, you know, my dad's illustrated all this stuff for me as, you know, as an adult. I've asked him to illustrate it. And as a kid, you know, he would make these little sketches. And I wish I could go back and tell myself to save those sketches when I was a kid. Because he used to do it all the time, you know.
So for 4 years.
Yeah, 4 years.
That's incredible.
And he's not the only, like, my family's not the only family that's done that. You know, it's well documented in the Philippines. A lot of people ran into the woods ran into the jungle to get away. Because the Japanese Imperial Army, they were vicious. Like, they were killing people left and right that were supporting the American soldiers left over when MacArthur left.
Yeah.
And they really just had a very different mindset. And we weren't prepared to fight that enemy in a land battle. They were just plain vicious. I mean, they would have done things to my family in the Philippines that my grandfather wasn't willing to risk.
Right.
He said, screw it. We're going to the jungle. And that's where we're living. And then they got word that MacArthur came back. They came back to their house and they found that everything was destroyed. Things were looted, stolen. And whether it was the Imperial Army or just people that were exploiting the state of emergency, but everything was destroyed. And my dad and his family had to rebuild. When I tell people, you know, hey, I totally believe that society can collapse and it has before. They're like, oh, where has it happened before? And I'm thinking to myself, man,
well,
let's sit down for a cup of coffee and I'll tell you a story or two.
That is incredible. So they survived for 4 years with a bunch of people in
correct.
A cave system. And they just...
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it's imagine this, like picture being a little kid, you're hearing these stories. And no offense to anyone that's like into professional sports. It's really not my thing. I couldn't tell you more than three people on any football team or basketball team or anything like that. But if I had to choose between a professional sport and like learning how to throw a football in the backyard or hanging out with my dad, learning all about trapping or learning how to build fires and how to make weapons, like that's what I did as a kid, you know? And that's how I really got interested in it. You know, my dad just wanted to show me, look, this is what I did as a kid. And this is, I know it's what you like. So I'm just going to keep doing it. I'll entertain your interest as long as you want.
Yeah, that's incredible. So he got you into it, and you started as a young age. It seems like at some point you had some actual training. At what point did you? Yes. What point did that happen?
I mean, I guess you could call it training. At a young age, I started reading as many survival manuals as I could get my hands on. I had copies of the Military Survival Manual and all these different books by like Bradford Angiers and Tom Brown Jr. and you name it. I had all their books on my shelf as a little kid, and I would go through and look at the pictures because I thought those were really cool.
Yeah.
Over time, I started picking up different types of training, like canoeing and kayaking training, learning how to, you know, whitewater kayak, how to load canoes, and then I eventually started working at a canoe shop. So I started doing a lot, just applying what I already knew in that job. But I also was working at Eastern Mountain Sports at the time, and they offered rock climbing lessons and ice climbing lessons to the employees. So I learned through Eastern Mountain Sports. And then at some point, like I guess the truly first formal lesson I ever had was with the Maine Primitive Skills School. I was like, let me just see if I know the stuff that my dad taught. Like, let me just see if it's relevant to New England, you know, and let me take a formal class. So I started training with those guys, Jack Mountain Bushcraft up in New Hampshire when they were there. Now they're up in Maine. Mm-hmm. And then in 2006, I settled on the Wilderness Learning Center after going to a seminar that the owner, he and his wife were putting on in North Carolina. And I was like, man, this guy is good. You know, he's a Vietnam veteran, former Army survival instructor, full-time survival instructor. This guy's just awesome. I took his class and I was like, this is the school. Like, this is the school, the guy that I want to learn from. And that was in 2006.
Wow. So you've been doing it basically since then?
Formally, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. My boss up there in 2007, I wanted to go back for the advanced class. I wanted to go back for the plant class. And he goes, well, I want you to come up a little bit early. So I went up early and there's a class going on. And next thing you know, he says in front of the class, by the way, that's Kevin. He's my instructor. and it was kind of like I was voluntold that I'm going to be teaching. So
that's funny.
You know, yeah, he's a good dude. And ever since then, he's trusted me to teach classes. And, you know, we had a lot of fun teaching everyone from private citizens and soccer moms to guys that were different federal agents and some guys that were Army guys paying out of pocket. So we had a good group of people up there, a lot of great students.
Do you travel to teach people in different types of environments?
Yes. I'll travel if people want me to. I've flown out to Washington State to teach, Michigan, Florida. You know, of all the areas that I could say are my strengths and my weaknesses, I would say that, you know, anywhere in the northern hemispheres, that's really my go-to. It seems like the environment follows latitude as opposed to longitude.
Right.
So I found the same plants everywhere from Sweden to Iceland to Alaska and all points in between. As I go further south, like down towards Georgia, you start seeing different types of pine trees, different types of plants. And, you know, the place that really, really gets me and I can't wait to train there again is the desert. You know, it's a spot that is a weakness, but I enjoy the adversity of training in a place that's not familiar and learning as much as I can from that type of environment.
So you spend a lot of days in the woods.
Hell yeah.
How many nights a year are you out in the backcountry or the bush?
At my peak when I was teaching up at the Wilderness Learning Center in the summers and when we would travel, I estimated it was anywhere between 45 and 60 nights out in the woods. It's kind of slowed down a little bit with all the writing that I've been doing.
Right.
But I get out every single week as much as possible. I was just out hiking today, you know, just kind of checking out the trails on the last day of winter. It's a little bit tough just because with all the deadlines with the magazines, I can't get out as much as I want. But, you know, the lines are very blurred right now between work and play. You know,
sure.
If I'm going out fishing or if I'm going out, you know, with my friends, I forget that I might be doing work or I might be doing work and I might forget that I'm doing work and I might just start enjoying it.
Right.
So I've lost count of, I don't even count the days anymore. I just know that it's up there.
It's a lot, and it's enough to get you some good experience. I would imagine you've had some pretty rough experiences. You got any that come to mind that were especially rough?
Yeah. Speaking of the desert, back in 2016, I got hired by the History Channel to be a co-host of a show that we just filmed the pilot, and the pilot never got picked up by the network. It was approved, and then along the way, the guy that greenlit the project left the network, was replaced by someone else, and the new guy said, well, it's a beautiful show, but it doesn't fit the direction I want to take the network. So thank you, but no thank you.
Okay.
So that's kind of like the premise of where I'm going here. But
yeah,
we were in the desert. We were in the Mexican desert just east of Tijuana. It was 28 miles of a desert crossing that we did in 3 days. We had very minimal equipment. We started off without any water. We had to find water. And along the way, we found no food whatsoever. Like, very, very unripened juniper berries and maybe like a little bit of agave that was really, really just past its prime.
Yep.
And along the way, got sick as a dog. My contestant that I was taking through the desert, he got sick. I got sick. I mean, that was really one of the worst just because it's Mexican water.
Mm-hmm.
Even though we treated it, there was still chances that something bad was going to happen. And
Montezuma's revenge.
Oh my God. When you explode from both ends, you really reach the bottom of the barrel.
And you're in the desert.
He's been very vengeful to me a couple times.
Has he? Yeah. Has he gotten you? He does not like your gringo ass. So you take a lot of people out in the backcountry. I would imagine you see people of very different backgrounds in terms of skills and experience. What areas of survival is the average person like least proficient at or maybe worst at?
I would say that you know, a lot of people understand fire. I mean, most people, if they're an adult, they've lit a match or they know how to light a lighter. And, you know, they have the concepts down. They know that the fire is supposed to have air. They know that they're supposed to add fuel to it. But what I find is that people have, it's not so much one particular area that they struggle with. It's just the comfort. You know, I find that when you tell someone, all right, we're going to sleep in a debris shelter, or we're going to use just a tarp, and we're going to stuff a garbage bag filled with leaves, and you're going to sleep on top of that. They're used to the comfort at home, and they're not used to pressure testing themselves. So when they feel the slightest thing crawling on them, they sleep horribly. When they can't just turn on a light and see what that noise was, and they have to let their mind wander.
Yeah.
That's what's really, I think,
the
number one thing that stands out. Oh, yeah, we're our own worst enemies.
Yeah.
There's a reason why kids do better in the bush than adults, because they don't think the way that we do, and they just think it's a game, and they don't have years of watching the news and movies and all these influences that make you think that, like, the boogeyman's out there. That I think, would be the standout for me. Is, like, you can always teach a person how to make cordage or build a fire or cook over a fire or whatever, but getting them into that comfort zone when they're uncomfortable, yeah, that's the hardest.
Are you kind of guiding them into what you're bringing out there? Like, do you give them a checklist of stuff they need to bring, or is it kind of, hey, I've taught you, and now you need to just do it?
You know, some people will ask me right off the bat, they'll be like, well, what do you carry?
Mm-hmm.
Like, listen, what I carry is what works for me. I don't want you to become a clone of me. I want you to become the best version, the most prepared and capable of yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, own it. So a lot of people will ask me, what should I carry? And I'll give them the basics. And along the way, I'm a huge proponent of scribing, you know, taking good notes. And I always have people, like, say, all right, when you're working in the outdoors, keep track of what you actually used, keep track of what you wanted, keep track of what you didn't use, but you're glad you had it just in case.
Yeah.
You know, and every time that you go out, you always learn from the last trip that you went on. And you say, well, I should have packed this. Well, that's what you load up on next time. And you always pack to your weakness too. So if someone doesn't know how to build fire by friction, then they're going to carry extra fire starters and carry them across their body in different places.
Mm-hmm.
But if someone is really up for the challenge, then we'll carry some gear just as a backup, as an emergency, but we'll really push them and see how far they can go with using as few resources as possible.
Yeah, that makes sense. And that makes me think. So one thing we ask a lot of people that are on is what's the most useless thing in your pack? You know, we have a lot of hunters and stuff on.
Yeah.
And I feel like you'd be like the worst person to ask that question to.
Oh, my God. I'll tell you something. If you give me enough free time, I could find ways of hurting myself or someone else just by messing with things, putting things together.
Right.
The most useless thing in my pack, that's really, really a tough question.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, God, I couldn't say it's a knife. I couldn't say it's rain gear. I couldn't say it's cordage. There are so many things that I carry that are all very, very specific, and I try not to waste.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like you have an unfair advantage in this question.
I know. I'm
guessing
your time
all,
is spent.
All the equipment you're bringing out there is multi-purpose.
Exactly.
Very much so. Yeah. I mean, let me put it this way. There's stuff that I carry out there that is strictly for pleasure, for fun. I'll bring out a package of Backwoods cigars, you know?
Nice.
I mean, I guess that,
yeah,
maybe it's useless. I mean, it's more comfort than necessity.
You're telling me if you were down in Mexico, you couldn't find a tobacco plant growing somewhere and just roll one
up? Yeah. Well, so that's the thing. In Mexico, there are a couple times we're walking across the terrain down there, and the security guards are saying to us, no, 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 narco, narco. And the security guards were following our group along with the production crew, and they were pointing out fence lines that we weren't supposed to cross because of known drug activity.
Yikes.
So, you could find the drugs down there. There's no doubt.
You could have yourself a good time and die in the desert.
A special cigar.
That's right. So, one thing that we debate about a lot, we spent a lot of time thinking about this, talking about it, picking your camp spot backcountry.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
For example, this year we went to Colorado, and it was end of October. We're at about maybe 10,000 feet, 9,000 feet. It's just a little bit of snow. So we're pretty far back. We're trying to figure out with these conditions, what's the best spot? How do you go about picking a spot to set up camp?
So I always think of the W's. I think of the wind, the wiggles, and widowmakers, and also water. Wind, wiggles, widowmakers, and water. I want to know where the prevailing wind is.
Mm-hmm.
I want to know which direction it's coming from, because that will help me orient the front of my shelter the direction I need it to be. I also want to be concerned with, all right, if this is the direction that the wind is coming, where's my egress point to, like, a point of safety in case that shelter isn't it? Right. If it's really coming through, how do I get back down to a lower elevation or into denser woods or whatever it may be?
Right.
I'm always concerned about the wiggles. You know, I don't like setting up shelters places where, you know, there's going to be a lot of insects. So buy water, and I'll get to that in a second. Water, you're going to get all the mosquitoes. But, you know, depending on where you are, you also don't want to get ticks. You know, Connecticut's the home of Lyme disease. So I'm always concerned setting up shelters. I'm always trying to find ways of minimizing my exposure to the things that could do more harm to me in the long term, like little ticks. I'm concerned with widowmakers, you know, the things that could fall on me in the middle of the night. First thing in camp, I always look up. I'm looking for any tree branches, and I'm also looking for the trees just outside of my camp area that might be really tall that could fall into my immediate area, you know, that might get unnoticed. And then the last thing's water. I'm looking on the ground, making sure that I'm not camping in an area that gets saturated. I'm looking to see if the ground is level, seeing if it's the high point or the low point. Colorado is one of those places where the other thing you got to consider out in Colorado, you got the big cats out there. And I heard someone say, if you're living in, or if you're camping in Colorado at altitude like that, and you're in big cat country, the cat has visited you at some point in the night and it just decided that you weren't worth its time. So, you know, you always have to be concerned with camp security as well.
Yeah.
Two-legged and four-legged critters. And always be concerned that, you know, where you're camping might be attractive to you, but it's probably attractive to someone or something else.
Yeah, we've dealt a little bit with that too. So
cats? I haven't had a cat.
You haven't?
No.
No, we had a little bit of that.
Tabby cat, maybe?
Not yet. Well, that's Michigan's a little different. Although we have...
Bobcat.
You know, we had a mountain lion up in Big Rapids.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
So not too far away.
That's besides the point.
Yeah. So you're looking at those, the W's. How, you know, like what, when you're setting up, how do you know where to position, you know, in terms of wind, for example? Do you want to be in the thick woods with the wind coming down at you or over top of you, or how are you setting up?
I mean, I guess it's scenario dependent. If I'm using an enclosed tent, or if I'm using like a heated shelter that I can close a door, then the wind really doesn't matter too much to me at that point. But I do a lot of hammock camping. So I don't want to create a wind tunnel where that wind is blowing right through that A-frame that's created with my tarp. I mean, I'm fine with it blowing perpendicular to my tarp because I can stake it down really well. And I get minimal wind that comes in through like the eddy that's formed around it. If I face it directly into the wind, it could be a horrible night's sleep. You know, I usually try to find the heavier woods where, you know, the trees are going to block a lot of the wind, or I'll try to find a natural feature like a hillside. I don't like camping out in open fields just because the wind just goes right through it. And I also try to avoid any draws where I'm in a valley and the wind just comes down through that valley and it kind of accelerates. Yeah. You know, it could be compressed and accelerates if you camp in the center of it. So
yeah, we've had some,
usually look for.
We've had some rough times trying to hammock camp. One night, I think it broke in the night when we were in Colorado 2 years ago. And I mean, we got wet. Then there was a snowstorm and it got ugly pretty fast.
But Tommy.
Tommy, you know, we threw him in the vestibule of another tent, but it got pretty hairy that night. So
yeah, it's a...
Go ahead.
Hammock camping, I was going to say, hammock camping, people either love it or they hate it. You know, they try it once and they're like, I can't sleep like that. Or they never want to go back to the ground. I mean, I don't see how after that experience you'd want to go back, but I would just tell you, just stick it out. You know,
it's comfortable.
It is. Yeah.
You know, when it's light. Yeah. I like it.
Yeah. It's not bad.
We've been doing the floorless teepee lately. Pretty nice. Pretty warm.
I'd say that stove is quite the luxury.
Yeah. It's not super survival, but you're staying warm back there.
Yeah. Patrick Smith from Kafaru, he was really one of the guys that innovated that stuff. And he said that, you know, the floorless tent has so many benefits. The ability to walk into your shelter without taking off your boots, the ability to process wood into your shelter, and it saves weight. And, you know, I've got that heated shelter and I love mine just to be able to dry out any insulating layers. A lot of people think, oh, in the winter, you just need insulation, you can camp out indefinitely. But we forget how much we sweat through all
those
layers.
You get all wet. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's ice inside those insulating layers. So it's just to have that ability to dry out everything is a godsend.
Yeah, it is. And there's just a ton of information you got to learn before you're actually heading out there. And, you know, you always see these guys on YouTube either going out there and failing completely or just kind of going out there and thinking they're doing the right thing, but they are getting out there. So good on them. But how long does it typically take for someone to kind of get wilderness ready and is kind of ready to spend maybe one or two nights out in the bush by themselves even?
I mean, one of the things I advocate is always backyard training, you know, and there's no shame in telling someone, look, I tried it in my backyard before I took it out, you know, to the state park or wherever it may be. And you always have that security blanket of, okay, I realized by camping in my backyard or camping, you know, in this relatively safe environment, somewhat controlled environment, that I need a warmer bag. And I would rather have someone say that than for someone to say, well, I brought it out there and it was too cold. And then I had to call search and rescue because I couldn't get out of my shelter. You know what I mean? So it varies from person to person. And that's really an assessment that they have to make. Some people, they'll never be ready. And you know what? I have no problem saying that they'll never be ready. And I'm okay with that because, you know, then they need to realize that they have to stay closer to civilization.
Right.
Some people are just badasses and it's like they're born ready. And you're welcome. You know, and they just go out there and they learn by doing, and they just have that ability to suck it up. And they've got that grit that some people will never, ever understand because they just know how to live through that adversity. So I think it varies from person to person.
But that goes right back to what you said about most of it's the mental aspect of being out in the woods.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a physical aspect of wiping your ass with snow.
Yeah.
You know, like that's the type of thing I told my buddy Jerry, this goes back like 12 years ago now. I said, dude, you got to wipe your ass with snow. And he said, you're joking. I said, no, really, it's a clean wipe. You're going to love it.
Oh, yeah.
He goes, no, you're really joking. I said, trust me. It's only cold for a little bit, but like, that's it. Like
it'll wake you up.
And so Jerry did that and came back and he goes, oh my God, I feel fresh as a daisy in a school play. And then, he told his buddies, and Jerry's a cop, and his buddies were like, you didn't. He goes, no, I did. And they were all like, were your friends playing a cruel joke on you?
Yeah, right.
That doesn't seem normal, but some people will never be ready for that. Some people will try it.
Hey, wait, why does that work? I always bring wet wipes. So you're telling me I can wipe in snow?
No.
So to quote my buddy Scott Gossman, he says, if you don't protect your wet wipes in the winter, it's like trying to wipe your butt with a package of Steak-Ums.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
You know, so or Post-it notes. Keep them close to the body.
Yeah. Interesting. So snow just wipes you clean.
Well, you can clean your hands.
Yeah.
Off.
But here's the thing there. It's not all snow is created equally. You know, you don't want powder because it sticks to your cheeks.
Yeah,
and you don't want that granular icy snow because it cuts
super
you.
Scrubber.
Yeah, you want that good snowball snow.
Yeah, some like lake effect.
So you're saying I can make a snowball and just use those as kind
it's
of
more of like a snow wedge, I would imagine.
Yeah, so I'd go with the wedge cone shape.
That's funny. You know, I didn't know that. These are the kind of is this in your new book? Is this tip in your book? Is this
no
98 or something?
This is a hot boga tip.
That's a hot boga tip.
This is a hot boga tip. This is one of those things that I'll put in the second book if I'm offered it.
Okay.
But I didn't want to scare away readers at, you know, initially. Like, by the way, guys, you're going to have to wipe your ass with snow.
That's it. I'm out.
Yeah. That's funny. So your book, I wanted to bring that up. How has that been going? How'd it go to write that? Was that something you had 100 lined up in your mind, or was that something that took some, or 101 took some time to put together?
Quite honestly, I wrote the 101 skills down at a highway rest area while driving up to the survival school at the Wilderness Learning Center, driving up to it last year in February.
Wow.
Or last year in January. I received an email from the publisher, and you know they said to me, they're like, well, hey, could you get us a tentative idea of what you want to cover? So I stopped at the rest area, and I said, all right, I'm going to do this based on the 10 essential needs as opposed to just 101 random skills. I said, all right, there's going to be skills related to cordage and first aid. And so I just found 10 of 10 and I wrote them down. I sent them out. Next thing you know, they said, all right, get us one chapter that we can preview. And we want to be able to see how you write. They're like, it's going to be a little bit different than writing a magazine, which it was. You know, next thing you know, they said, all right, we like your chapter. Get us a table of contents. And these were emails like all over like a week or 2 weeks. So I sent them a table of contents and they said, hey, send us some sample photography. They approved my photography. They were happy that there weren't any toes in the photos or any weird lines or like they liked the photos. And then they said, all right, we'll get back to you. Now a month or two goes by. I haven't heard from them. So I finally reached out and like, hey, what's going on? You know, I sent you the sample chapter. They said, okay, well, we're going to send over the contract. This is in early April. And I signed it in early April. And they said to me, like, oh, well, you probably write quickly because you're a magazine writer. So most people do this in 6 months. I think you can get it done in 3. And I said, Sure. Challenge is accepted. So from April, May, and June, I wrote the book. I initially gave them 101,000 words because I figured, you know, that's what sounded right. About 1,000 words. They didn't tell me what the minimum or the maximum was.
Oh,
that was so nerve-wracking, because the first line of edits, my editor came back to me and she said, you need to cut a third of your book.
Holy.
I said, you've got to be kidding me. That's 30,000 plus words. So I started cutting, and I got down to about 85,000. And then she's like, no, we need more. I got to around 80,000 or 81,000. And I sent them a heartfelt email. And I said, listen, I can't cut anymore. If I cut anymore, it's going to lose the heart and soul of the book. I've cut out an entire chapter at the end, which is like an additional 15 or 20 bonus skills. And I said, we could do fewer photos in certain sections. We could do smaller font, but I can't cut out the text.
Right.
You asked me to write a book. I wrote a book. Let's go with it. So now it has 80,000 words in it.
I kind of want to know why they wanted you to cut words out of there.
Well, I feel like he probably felt a lot like Jefferson did after they kind of ripped apart all the writing he did, you know, for the...
I'm just saying, it's probably a lot of hard work going into
it. I would imagine. I mean, you pour your heart into it, and they're telling you to cut it out. It's got to be tough.
No, but really.
And the reason why is because my book was originally only supposed to be 192 pages. And when I sent them the 101,000 words, they said, if we were to print just the text alone, your book would be 240 something pages.
Yeah.
And for them to be able to sell it at the suggested retail price is like $21.99 or something like that, they said, we wouldn't be able to do that. So you have to cut it. I said, well, all right, what if we added all the photos? And they told me it was even more pages. So I cut out a whole chapter on going beyond the 101 skills. Like, I had a whole chapter on marksmanship. I had a whole chapter on learning how to do field repairs as like other essential skills that go beyond the survival skills, like more sustainment in the great outdoors.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, cut it. I had all these awesome stories about, you know, using some of the skills, you know, throughout my experience in the outdoors. They're like, cut those stories. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm losing so much of it. But
you saved them though, right? You've got them somewhere.
Oh yeah. I still have the original cut. You know, I made copies of copies, and the reason why I love doing, you know, podcasts like this one and interviews is because I get to tell some of the stories that were cut out, you know, like that thing with the History Channel, we built hotbeds and we slept pretty much on the ground on a bed of coals covered over with just a little bit of sand, and that kept us warm in the desert, you know, but that's cut out of the book, you know, and that's unfortunate, but that's what was needed in order to get it to print. And now it's 208 pages total.
You're still over.
I'm still over, but they were fine printing 208 pages. They were able to budget it just fine. But it would have been 192 if I submitted fewer words. It would have been well over 250 if they kept everything as is. I mean, maybe if this book sells a million copies, you know, being optimistic.
They'll ask you for number two.
Yeah, well, or that, or they'll say, give us the original cut of the writer's cut. And, you know, we'll print 250-something pages. But, yeah, they maybe eventually they'll ask me to submit the full writer's cut.
Yeah, I'd be interested to see that. Where I'm excited to see your book when it comes in. Now, if I read that cover to cover, say the average guy, a guy that hasn't spent Joe Schmo hasn't spent any time. We'll call him Joe City Slicker.
George or City Fichter.
Yeah. And, if he picks this book up, reads through 101, will he be able to go out and survive? Have you gotten him there with these kind of 10 areas?
I would say if he just read the mindset portion in the very beginning, that alone is enough to get a person already thinking the way that they need to. The average person, if they just look through and see the photos, they'll be able to learn visually. If they just read the introductory portion of each chapter without looking at each skill, they'll already have knowledge of theory. If the person that's very advanced says, well, I've already know all this stuff, at the end of every single chapter is a section on training modifiers. It's like, all right, you already know how to do this. Well, I can make it harder. And that's something that I've been told by students and other instructors. You're like, you're more of a coach than you are an instructor. Like, I know how to look at performance and make people work better instead of just accomplishing a task. I would say that the average person, though, I mean, if they pick up the book, they're definitely going to walk away with something and say, wow, there's a lot of juice in this. There's like a lot of good information. And again, if they just read the mindset section, then I think that will prepare them better on a daily basis, not just when they go in the woods.
Right. Yeah, because, I mean, knowing that something bad can pretty much always happen, whether you're in a car or you're not always going to necessarily be in a plane crash and have to survive on a desert island or whatever. But you still need to know some basic things just to be able to survive should anything happen.
Right, right. And we call it readiness. You know, in the first chapter, I bring up the training I've had with Sayoc Kali, which is a Filipino martial art. I'm an instructor in Sayoc, and we train a lot of different people, all different walks of life. But something that our system has created is this readiness formula. And, you know, in life, if you can find a formula, you can exploit it. If you can find a formula, you can use it to your advantage. So readiness is the concept of being equal parts aware, prepared, and willing, you know, and there are people that are aware and willing, they're just not prepared.
Right.
And there are people that are prepared and willing, they're not aware. You know, if someone's drinking and they lose their mental focus, well, they're definitely not aware.
Right.
You know, and the whole idea is that if you are constantly seeking that readiness by becoming more and more aware each day or prepared or willing each day, then you're working towards a better version of yourself in the end. And you can apply that to anything, to archery. You can apply that to fitness.
Yeah.
You can apply that to your diet. You can apply that to being, you know, the most productive person at work.
Right.
Right. So a lot of the concepts you can take from the great outdoors, you can apply pretty much anywhere. You know, they're universal, and that's why they're so important.
So this readiness is a lot of mental. How do you prepare yourself mentally? How do you practice the mental side of things?
Well, I'm sure you've probably met people who, like, when they've encountered something, they say, they freeze, right? Mm-hmm. You've heard of people that have like the fight or flight response and they have the freeze response. Well, if you're really good at awareness, then you'll do your research ahead of time and you'll start visualizing and running mental repetitions of what it would be like to experience something before it even happens to you.
Yeah.
You know, we always say, like, you don't have to wait for something to happen to you to experience it for the first time.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Like, yeah, absolutely.
Like if I were to tell someone right now, like, all right, you're in your car, the car goes off of an embankment and now it's filling with water. You know, you can already start getting people into the moment and you can start explaining, all right, what would you do? So if they start thinking about that, when that eventually happens, if it happened, they could say, well, I've thought about this already.
Yeah.
I know what I'm doing. You know, and the more that you run those repetitions, the more capable you're going to become in the end, the more ready you're going to become, because it's not like you're going to be thinking, you're going to be responding correctly.
Yeah.
You know? And that's something that is so, so important in anything that we do. Yeah. I mean, so I'm sorry. So one of the things, like you can apply this in anything. Like, you could talk about, all right, I'm going to go up and talk to that pretty girl.
Yep.
Right. And you have all these ideas in your head of what could possibly happen.
Tom, so are you listening? Are you listening to this, Tom? Tom's the single guy here. I want to make sure Tom is getting all the facts for talking to pretty girls. He's my brother. So my daughter needs a good aunt. So just listen up here a second. Yeah. Go ahead.
So I mean, this is one of those things that, like, this is the talk that I wish I had when I was a little kid, because it would have definitely saved some embarrassment. And definitely in the college years. But I mean, whether you're talking to the pretty girl or you're asking your boss for the raise, or you know that you're responding to an email from someone that is not so pleased with you, whether it's a parent, you know, in my job as a teacher, or, you know, I'm replying to a company that I'm trying to work with and they're, you know, they're being reluctant on doing a design change or whatever. You can always visualize multiple responses. And you've probably played this game already with your friends or with your loved ones, saying, well, if this happens, I'm doing this. Right? Like the what if game. Well, what if this guy crosses the street? We're going to cross the street. Well, what if there's a fire? Where are the exits? Well, what if there's a fire and everyone's at the exits? Well, where are the exits that are exits, but not exits that are very convenient, because there'll probably be fewer people there.
Yep.
You know, and you start running these mental repetitions and you experience it before it happens.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring that up. And even the example of a car filling with water. For me, most of my life, I was reactionary, where, you know, I wouldn't think about things ahead of time. I was younger anyways. But when in college, I got in an accident, a car accident, where the car actually did flip, roll over a few times and land underwater. After, you know, it was me, my wife, or it was my girlfriend then, and two girls in the back, and never having thought that anything like that could ever happen, to being literally underwater, upside down, pitch black. And it's funny though, since that happened, I think about what would I do if this happened a lot, but I don't think I would have had that not happened.
Your situational awareness is just a little bit more in tune.
Yeah.
You're aware of your environment a little more. And
for a while, it would be really probably graphic and not so healthy, the things that you would be like, what if this happened? But after a while, you know, kind of working through it, it was like, well, if this happened, I think I would be ready, because this is what I would do. But again, I never would have thought of that had that not happened.
And you know something, you nailed the nail right on the head, because you said, you know, paranoia, or, you know, you said like it can drive you crazy thinking about it all the time. And what happens is that within the survival community, the bushcraft community, it seems like there's a healthy balance of that what if game, right?
Yeah.
And you have to be realistic with your threat assessment.
Yeah.
You know, what is the realistic threat you're going to experience as, say, like a 40-year-old man who drives a mile to work,
right?
You know, and you live a very low profile life. You're probably not going to be, probably aren't going to be kidnapped by a cartel.
That's
you probably
right.
don't need to know certain skills, but it doesn't hurt to know them. What happens is many times people in the survival community, they go above and beyond, and they become that paranoid person that we all know, who is stockpiling, you know, for every possible contingency when it's not the most realistic one.
Right.
You know, and you just got to be really honest with yourself. And that's something that's missing from the community, is that people love selling drama.
Yeah, sure.
And there's a lot of survival schools, and I'm not going to say names, but we all know them, that they sell drama. They sell a vision of yourself that's never going to come to fruition, when they should be doing you a better service, just making you prepared for what's realistic.
Yeah, well, actually, the zombie apocalypse probably won't be happening, but there
thank
are...
You, thank you for saying probably.
Yeah, probably. I'm not saying it won't.
Yeah, but the machete sales have skyrocketed.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. You can hack those things. But it's funny, because it's like it's a fine line between preparedness and readiness and health. Like, once you cross that line, it's not probably healthy to be physically or mentally, to be just constantly thinking about the weirdest, worst thing that could happen.
It almost even sounds like a mild case of PTSD. And I'm not going to say that anyone who has gone through those type of situations now have that, but you hear the symptoms of disorder, and it's almost along those kind of same lines. But
I mean, especially if it comes from a traumatic event, I definitely had to work through that and talk to somebody and everything else. But when you get past it, then you suddenly, like I was saying, now it's like a healthy way to think about it. Now here's what you do to be prepared, and you're more alert, and you're just present that way.
Right. And you know, something that's really important, a lot of people use the word victim, you know, and they say, well, I'm a victim of this. Well, victim is a word that other people assign to you. You know, I'd rather say I'm a survivor. I'm a survivor of that. You know, victim is such a negative word that implies weakness. Like you had no control.
And helplessness. Control.
Yes.
Yep.
It's like, okay, when that car flipped over, no, you're a survivor because you cracked that window, or, you know, you pried open the door. You did something right. You're not a victim of a car accident. You're a survivor of it.
Right.
You know, and that's an important thing that people need to do to reframe their understanding of themselves and the power that they have. Whether I'm teaching survival or martial arts, or I'm talking to my high school students, I always tell them, like, look, you guys should always embrace power, embrace strength. You know, if you can, you know, if you have an option to be strong or weak, be strong.
Right.
You know, and never apologize for it, because that's a good thing for you.
Yeah. I mean, it's a lot of who you are comes down to what you tell yourself, the words you use. So victim implies you've already lost. A survivor implies you've won. And if you're still walking around, you've won.
Correct. Yes.
Yeah. That's an interesting point. And it's, you know, like I said, it's something that you've just got to work through. And it's the mental part, which, like you said, is probably the hardest part and most important too.
And that's the reason why it's number one, the first chapter in the book. You know,
if
I can catch people with just that first chapter and they say, well, I didn't get anything out of this book. Maybe after like a month of sleep cycles, they'll say, well, wait a minute, I read this in a book. And they come back to the book and they realize why the rest of it's important. But at least I got them on that first part, which, again, applies to everything in life.
Yeah.
You know? And that's really the value of that book and that training.
Yeah, that's incredible. And I would imagine, so you move from that to skills, and I would imagine you cover some maybe gear related areas. Is that in the book?
Yeah, very, very, very basic gear. I mean, as an outdoors writer and as someone who loves gear, I have a lot of it. And I have to be real careful when I'm writing a book like that, or I'm teaching in class, that it's not just a show and tell, because there's a tendency to enjoy gadgets too much.
Right.
So I keep it very basic. And I say, look, you need to have your basic needs met. You need to have certain amounts of cordage. You need to have certain amounts of, you know, illumination tools, whether it's a headlamp and a flashlight, your navigation tools. And I said, you know, I left it very open, because what works for you might not work for me, and vice versa. So again, I didn't want to prescribe too much gear, and many of the skills can be done with the most basic equipment. And then you can always add on to that. But once you have your basic skills, you know, that's what's going to protect you. You may lose gear. You can have it stolen. It can be, you know, it can break, but you can always fall back on the skills.
Yeah, absolutely. When you're loading up just to spend some time in the woods, mm-hmm. no matter how long you're going out, what are some of the things that, no matter if it's a day trip or a week trip, what are you always bringing with?
I work in concentric layers. Okay. And every single day, I always have a Swiss Army knife in my pocket. I always have a lighter in the other pocket. I'm not even a smoker, but I have a lighter on me every single day.
Yeah.
I always have a flashlight in my pocket. If I'm not teaching at the high school, if I'm legally able to, I always have a firearm on me. Mm-hmm. I always have a fixed blade on me. I don't carry folding tactical knives because, you know, we've pressure tested folding knives under stress and mm-hmm. nothing is faster than a fixed blade. Even switchblades aren't as fast as a fixed blade.
Right.
I carry a tourniquet every single day, right? Because the chance of you getting to an accident in the road, very high, you know, and in this day and age, working in a school, you know, as much as people don't want to admit yeah. it, tourniquets mm-hmm. save lives and school shootings happen. So without fail, every single day, it's a Swiss Army knife in one pocket, a flashlight and a lighter in another, a bandana in my back pocket, which doubles as a pressure bandage, a tourniquet that I usually have on my person somewhere. And then when I go out into the woods, I take that concentric layer, or I take that one layer and I add to it.
Yeah,
the knife becomes bigger, becomes a sturdy 4-inch belt knife. And then I carry a titanium water bottle and I just build the layers out from there. And I think of realistic needs. So if I had to spend the night, do I have the gear that I need to build a fire, to create a shelter, to drink water, to signal? Yes. And then I just keep building from there. And then the sky's the limit when it comes to like backpacking trips, canoe trips, road trips, whatever it may be.
One question that I have, and you brought up, you know, earlier, like mapping software or mapping a mapping tool or a map or a GPS or a compass or mm-hmm. something. One thing that I've struggled with, it got us into, so last year we wanted to hunt a new place in Colorado, and I found what I thought would be this amazing spot. Turns out I didn't read the topo map right. And like we got out there and it was so much steeper than I could believe, you know, especially coming from a pretty flat place like Michigan. How does one practice or get better with topo map lines and just kind of seeing it? Because some people can look at it after some time and just kind of see what the 3D image actually looks like.
One of the best things that I've ever learned for teaching people about topographical maps is get pieces of cardboard and cut cardboard into all sorts of weird oblong shapes and whatnot, and then stack them on top of each other. Mm-hmm. And look at it from the side so you can get an idea when you have all the pieces of the cardboard stacked. Mm-hmm. And then without disrupting the cardboard, look at it from the top down and you'll be able to see the outline of all the pieces. Mm-hmm. And those outlines will represent the contour lines on a map.
Interesting.
So you can create peaks, you can create plateaus. You know, it's one of the easiest ways of teaching people, all right, when there are close lines together, you're going to get a cliff. And you put all the pieces of the cardboard together where it almost looks like one line, and you then tell them, well, look at it from the side, you know, and that's what you're going to see from that angle. Just using those, we call them cardboard cookies. Mm-hmm. When you use those cardboard cookies, oh my God, you can see a noticeable difference in your students, or I mean, obviously you're not going to see it in yourself, but you can watch people say, oh my God, that's that. Yeah. Like they pick up on it so fast. Yeah.
You're just adding a three-dimensional.
Yeah. We used to use sand. Had a big square box of sand, mm-hmm. and then mm-hmm. it was just, you'd make it all flat, and then you would contour the terrain with sand, little tools, and you're able to see, you know, the contour of the elevations.
Yeah, that's interesting because it's hard to visualize it when it's flat and it's just lines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we're very interesting creatures as humans. You know, we live in a 3D world, and then we're told suddenly, all right, look at this two-dimensional object, and you know, understand where you're going based on this. Oh, and by the way, it is 1/24,000 smaller than reality.
Right.
You know, or 1/50,000 smaller than what you're going to be in. But go ahead, figure that out.
Yeah.
So yeah, you need to stack things in your favor.
Yeah, because when you get out there, and I even have this probably embarrassingly so, but you look at a map, you study it so long, and you get an image in your head. And when you get there, or you've already been there, and you're walking along, it's like things don't seem to match up always what you see on your map and in your head once you're in it.
And you know something that comes back to readiness.
Yeah.
You know, you become aware that you know that that's a possibility, and it's one thing to say, well, no, it's going to always look like this. If you go into that situation, if you go into that environment with a preconceived idea of what it's going to look like, I mean, it helps to do the map recon, but if you have an idea, your idea could be wrong.
Right.
You know, you could be in a different location. You really have to constantly assess, you know, what you're seeing and if it matches up to what you had. And that's something that, people have been killed because of their ego. Right. I can't be wrong. There's right. no way I'm wrong. I've been doing this for 20 years, you know? Well, people that have been doing it for 20 years have been killed by their ego. So.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's a huge deal. It's the backcountry hubris. Would you say so, Jared? Yeah.
Absolutely.
Fire making, super important. What types of tools should you have to make a fire when you go out in the woods? Is this, you know, will a Zippo do? Well, Bic lighter, wood matches, flint, steel? What do you?
Fat wood.
Yeah. What do you usually recommend?
So, I mean, if you're looking for the tool that has the greatest number of positive attributes, the greatest number of fires that are capable with it, yep. greatest amount of durability, greatest amount of water resistance, the ferro rod, you know, the metal match is really hard to beat. But you also have to understand the limitations. You know, mm-hmm. it's a spark-based fire starter. It's not a flame. Yeah. So mm-hmm. I always tell people that they should carry a minimum of two different types of fire starters.
Okay.
So every single day, in addition to that lighter in my pocket, I've got a really small personal emergency kit. I don't even call them survival kits because that's a mindset thing.
Sure.
The emergency yeah. is short term, survival is in case the emergency doesn't get resolved quickly. So
gotcha.
It's my emergency kit in my pocket. But I carry a small ferro rod in that pocket. So I carry a flame starter and a spark starter, something that's flame based and fire based. And then the having tinder is so incredibly important.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yes, not you can go out and you can we're not talking about swiping left or right.
Yeah, okay.
You definitely want to carry stuff on you if you can, and it's super lightweight anyway. Yeah. So I don't see why people would have a hard time carrying tinder, because incredibly increases your odds of building that fire if you have something that's going to readily catch fire.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of stuff that's out there you can carry. I mean, you mentioned the Zippo.
Yeah.
Zippos have a tendency of leaking fuel unless you
yes,
put a bike inner tube around. Put a bike inner tube around the seal, and it kind of makes it last a little bit longer.
Okay.
But a Bic lighter is fantastic. A ferro rod's fantastic. There's a lot of novelty ways of making fires out there. Some guys love flint and steel, but it's an inferior spark.
Right.
And I get it. You know, it's traditional. But if my life is on the line, I'm not playing games. I don't want to be cute.
No. I just want to start a fire.
I want 5,000 degrees instead of 1,800.
That's right.
You know what I mean? Like, give me a freaking road flare, you know? So I tell people, carry what works for them. Carry multiple means. Don't carry everything in the same spot, because if you lose it, then you might be screwed. You know, so fire starting, I would say, is something that people need to prepare for. And you can never carry enough fire starting gear. Like, have multiple layers of it.
Yeah, so like a piece of cotton and Vaseline kind of deal.
Oh, fantastic, bring with, yeah.
You know. You bring any of that with you, Jared, when you go out?
I've actually been rocking fat wood, just a little chunk of it.
Yeah.
I keep it in an old kind of pill bottle, so it's somewhat tall enough, maybe about 2.5-3 inches.
Yeah. Keeps it nice and dry. That lights up real good.
Yeah. And I'll shave off a couple pieces, and then I've got a ferrule rod that I'm able to strike, and I've got it to light before. So
yeah.
Did a little backyard test out, and it worked fine. So
yeah.
I'm sticking with it because it works.
Yeah, I do. I try to bring one like that, and I also carry, I think, whenever we go hunting, I've got a lighter in my bino harness, in my pocket, and in my pack. Because at the end of the day, for me, that's the easiest one. And I know, I mean, I've got other things to start fires with, but if I could get a Bic lighter working, then I'm going to go that route.
Yeah. And you know, the Bic is if people were to ask me like, hey, what do you reach for first? It's usually my lighter.
Yeah.
Like I've started, I don't know how many fires with a ferro rod, but I think of that as a very emergency piece of kit right there.
Yeah.
Whereas the Bic lighter, it's 99 cents. If it doesn't work, I can fall back on the ferro rod.
Right.
But I prefer starting a fire with a flame to a spark almost any day. You know, with the exception of like places where it's not going to work that great, like in the cold or at altitude or whatever, then the spark is sometimes superior. The fat wood works great. It's cool to know how to identify it off the land and to find it naturally. And what's really important is whatever you guys carry, whatever the listeners carry, is that you guys are constantly checking to make sure that you don't go through everything and you forget to replenish it when you get home.
Right, sure. Yeah, your stockpile. Well, and it comes down to, you know, energy used too. So, you know, the Bic is generally, you use the least amount of energy to light a fire with that as opposed to any other way of starting a fire. Yeah, so that's one of the things that I like to bring. Anyways, well, Kevin, you know, we're coming up on time here. I appreciate you hopping on the phone, bestowing a little knowledge. We're looking forward to your book. Jared's going to have it coming, and we'll be reading it, and hopefully not dying in the backcountry this year.
Yeah, when again when again does it come out, just so all the listeners kind of know?
Yeah, the book is right now available for pre-order on Amazon and Barnes and Noble and Books Million. It comes out April 16th. Leading up to the book's release, I'm going to be releasing more and more about it. So I've released like the back cover recommendations and a little bit of the tidbits on the inside. But on April 16th, right now I'm hearing that it's going to be delivered on April 16th to the people that have pre-ordered.
Nice.
A lot of people, they've had their orders updated from Amazon. So I'm just really psyched for people to see it and to power up and get stronger.
Yeah, we'll take a read. We'll post a little bit about it. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we appreciate it again. And where can, you said people can find it on Amazon and stuff. Where can people find out more about you and follow you and the work that you're doing?
I update Instagram regularly, like almost every single day. The Instagram account is Estella Wild Ed, just short for Estella Wilderness Education. My website is kevinestella.com. On Facebook, it's Estella Wilderness Education. You know, and I'm always open to answering questions. I don't think there's an email that goes without a response. So if anyone has any questions, I'm more than happy to respond. And if I don't know the answer, I'm not going to BS any of the listeners. I always tell people if I don't know the answer, I'll find the answer or point in the direction of the person that can answer it best.
Awesome. Yeah, you're a good resource to have around. We'll probably be hitting you up with some questions at some point, too.
Mm-hmm. Anytime, except for dating advice, you know, I think we exhausted that today. So
yeah,
you
know,
stay off of Tinder and
there's some good nuggets of wisdom and really, you know, envision it. If you can see it, you can do it, Tom. Don't take that literally. All right. Well, thanks, Kevin. We'll talk to you soon.
Yeah. Thanks, man.
Sounds great, guys. Have a good night.